You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good afternoon, Matt.
That's right, we're taping in the afternoon. We normally tape in the mornings. I'm more of a morning person. I'm at a hotel in New York. I just saw a woman go by in a robe in this hotel over here. So anyway, I'm using a window. You always have to have a bright light behind you. What you want. So I'm at a hotel. As long as the clouds stay exactly the same level, this won't be too weird. It'll look like I have a light. But anyway.
Well, while you're living the coastal elite life in a New York hotel for going on
to... I was in Oklahoma just yesterday. Oh, in Norman, Oklahoma. Mr. Cowboy hat.
You're probably doing some cultural tourism, seeing how the real people live for a day where you go off on CNN.
Yes.
I'm wearing my cowboy hat as a true real American.
This is the Montana, that's right. The era of, what's his name? I call him Swift. What's his name?
Quist. Rob Quist.
Quist.
This is in honor of tomorrow's Montana special. Partly because of the special, because of Quist, but I also noticed, because, you know, for those who aren't following the race closely, Rob Quist is Montana's one congressional district, so it's a statewide special election, because Ryan Zinke was named Secretary of the Interior, leaving the seat open. Both candidates, Republican Greg Gianforte and Democrat Rob Quist, were named in party conventions. They did not go through a primary process. And Quist is a locally known country singer and guitar player.
Who plays occasionally at nudist colonies?
I think he did one nudist colony.
Who among us?
Well, you know, I guess, well, let's get to that in a second. But Greg Gianforte was from New Jersey originally, but he moved to Montana a couple decades ago. CEO, businessman, millionaire. Ran for governor last year and lost, but it's a state Trump won by 20 points. Republicans should have the edge, and in most polls he does have the edge, but Quist is seen as being very competitive. And so he's always campaigning in his hat, a white hat, unlike mine.
Yeah.
I did see...
Can I just ask about the hat real quick?
Yeah.
So this is not... I'm just, you know, this doesn't look to be a normal cowboy hat. The brim... is a little tighter. This is more. I'm more like a folksy thing. Am I wrong?
Are you saying that I'm not a true blue cowboy in this hat?
No. I'm saying that it's not the kind of cowboy hat that you would wear like in Colorado or maybe even Montana. Maybe
like a straight.
Yeah,
that doesn't like, curl up at all.
This guy's got like a pretty hardcore curl.
Right. Well, yeah. This has been. Not very well kept, but it's got kind of a wire thing, so it's probably a little lopsided.
But so this other guy in Montana, who's a Democrat, looks like a cowboy, He looks like a Montana cowboy.
Yeah, I mean, he's born and bred in Montana. You know, family had a ranch, still has a ranch, I believe. But I did notice that one of the outside groups attacking Quist had a guy wearing a white cowboy hat and a beard like mine. And I don't know if someone in Montana would feel this way, but my reaction was... You found a schmuck like me from the East Coast, slapped a cowboy hat on him, and put him in an ad. That guy does not look like Montana at all.
They say all hat, no cattle, is what they call that. By the way, did you ever see that Ajit Pai thing where he has this oversized coffee cup? Well, have you seen this video?
That was in the John Oliver bit.
Yeah, this is my oversized water bottle. Courtesy of Fluffy's in New York, I reckon.
So anyway, so the race is tomorrow. Quist, so I'm going to segue to something that it should publish in Politico tomorrow on Thursday, which is about Democrats and guns. Not all of this race, but a good chunk of it has been about whether Quist believes in the Second Amendment or not. He made kind of a loose comment early on about guns being how it's okay if guns are registered. Quist says he was referring to assault weapons only, which apparently already have a registry. That would be something new. Forgive me if I'm getting my facts wrong, but that's my understanding of his argument. And of course, the Republicans have hammered him on this to say he wants to take away your guns. So Quist has done a couple ads where he's talking about, you know, this old rifle, this rifle has been in my family for three generations. He's caressing it like it's a pet. And he went in one ad, he, you know, locks and loads and plugs a TV showing an attack ad on him. And he says, you know, I'll protect your Second Amendment rights because it's my right too. Blam! And of course, Gianforte has plenty of ads where he's on a hunting trip and he's shooting things, and he's got the actual NRA endorsement, so that features prominently in his ad. So I don't know, not being on the ground there, to what extent people think Quist is on the level or not when it comes to this, if he's mitigated the issue for the race. But what was notable to me is the left has given him a total pass. There's no grumbling on the left that Quist is doing this. He's raising plenty of outside money. Bernie Sanders just campaigned for him. The DCCC is pumping money in there. MoveOn.org endorsed him, and in an article in The Nation, they said, didn't even come up. It wasn't even a factor in our endorsement. And this is very different than what you saw a few weeks ago when Bernie Sanders and the DNC endorsed Heath Mello for mayor of Omaha, because he had a voting record in the state legislature with some bills that were that restricted abortion rights. And Bernie said, hey, you can't run in Omaha the way you run in San Francisco. And Narol came out and said, you know, that's not acceptable. And basically threatened the DNC that they weren't going to back candidates, and the DNC was going to back folks who were anti-abortion. And then Tom Perez came out and said, everyone should be pro-choice, regardless of, this is not negotiable by city or state. Now, since then, Tom Perez is meeting with the Democrats for Life, so there's still some grumbling going on there. But the point is, there was this huge blowback to it that you don't see when it comes to guns. And this is also not just true for Quist, it's true for James Thompson in Kansas, who also campaigned in TV ads. He was holding an assault rifle in his ads. Quist is like having an old-timey rifle. John Ossoff, who is running less of a rural populist campaign because he's in suburban Atlanta, still, when asked, basically dodges the issue. It's not on his website. When he's asked point blank, he says, I'll support legislation that helps keep us safe and protects our Second Amendment rights. And he also notes that he grew up in a household with firearms. The only thing where Ossoff has shown some daylight with the Republican Karen Handel is that he is opposing a new Georgia law to have concealed carry on college campuses. But generally speaking, he's not running a pro-gun control campaign. So what I raise in my piece is this a conscious decision on the left to say, you know what, you know, we got to win back these Trump voters in these rural areas, and this issue just needs to be downplayed? Or is this just a sticking the fingers in the ears? You know, there hasn't been a public mass shooting in about a year, and basically the entirety of the Obama presidency, you didn't go for much more than a year between public mass shootings. It was a particularly heavy stretch of carnage. I mean, you know, the past, not necessarily the future, but there will be some public mass shooting somewhere in Trump's 4 years. I mean, that seems a safe, if tragic, bet. So when that happens, are Democrats prepared to say, as in Obama's first term, when he did not push any gun control measures, even though there was Aurora, Colorado, and Gabby Giffords and Fort Hood, they say, you know what, it's not the right time for this? Or is that post-Sandy Hook Democratic Party that said, who cares about the politics, this is the moral imperative, is it going to force them to take that issue head on, despite what Quist and Ossoff are doing right now. I don't think they've really come to grips with what they should do here, even though the politics are very fraught.
Well, since you brought up Sandy Hook, the obvious cynical response would be that when it comes to children, pro-lifers want to protect, you know, at least the unborn child. That's off, you know, that's a no-go zone. They're not so worried about the guns. So,
I mean, that's been the case, you know, this whole time, and you know, Democrats would raise things like that and call people on the right hypocrites. I mean, there definitely was a sense after Sandy Hook on the left that Sandy Hook changes the changes the political equation. How can you even suggest that we can't have something as minimal as increased background checks? It wasn't like people were talking about assault weapon bans or handgun bans. It's a pretty limited thing. They got Joe Manchin, who was NRA endorsed. They got Pat Toomey, who was NRA endorsed, to come up with a very limited bill. And that this is the time, and they still couldn't do it. And then Hillary Clinton, you know, despite warnings from Bill Clinton said after Sandy Hook, look, you can't just look at the poll numbers here. You have to. I come from this culture. These are folks who believe that, who don't want to change the hunting culture, or they live in an area where there's not a lot of police protection, or they just believe things that have been said over the course of the years. Like they look at that gun as something that means more than just a gun.
Well, that's certainly true. All right, so my cheap shot would be that, you know, this is consistent. They don't care about kids. They don't care about protecting them from abortion, and they don't care about protecting them from guns, but that's a cheap shot. I think what this really is, you know, I've talked about this before. I'm sure we've talked about it before. Donald Trump, I think we might have even talked about it last week, actually. Donald Trump won partly because he was this nationalist populist who, unlike Pat Robertson and Pat Buchanan and Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum, didn't have the social conservative baggage attached to him. So the point is that there is this cultural thing in the Rust Belt, in the Midwest, wherever. There is a cultural thing that Trump tapped into that is not religious or Christian, but it's cultural. And I would argue that the gun thing, the gun culture, the Western gun culture, is a very libertarian, individualistic thing that is much more in line with Trump country than the pro-life movement, which I would argue is a more Christian phenomenon.
Well, I raise this in the piece because this goes back to 2006. Remember, you know, Democrats ran on gun control in the 90s. Bill Clinton passed the Brady Bill, passed the assault weapons ban. They lost the Congress in 94, which some people attributed to those laws. But when Al Gore ran in 2000, Bill Bradley was coming up on his left. It's also 1 year after Columbine. And Gore, Governor of Tennessee, was once pro-gun rights. He swerves left to minimize daylight between him and Bradley. So he talks about a ban on cheap handguns amongst other and photo IDs. So he gets hit with that in the general election. He loses Arkansas, he loses Tennessee, he loses home state of Tennessee, he loses West Virginia. West Virginia voted for Mike Dukakis, didn't vote for Al Gore. Guns gets blamed all over again. And then from that point on, Democrats get increasingly sotto voce on guns.
Yeah.
The assault weapons ban lapses in 2004. John Kerry is for the ban, but he tries to mitigate that with the goose hunting trip in October of 2004, which doesn't work. So by 2000,
can I get me one of them licenses? Did he say something like that at a Kmart?
I don't know. But so 2006, the Democrats' downplay of guns pays off electorally.
This is
at the same time where a political scientist, Thomas Schaller, wrote a book called Whistling Past Dixie, to get back to your point, where he said, look, Democrats are not going to win the South. It's God, guns, and gays. It's socially conservative. There's no way you're going to overcome all of that. But in the West and in the Midwest, which is not as socially conservative, but is more libertarian. If you can get guns off the table, the rest of the economic program will get a hearing. And you had Jim Webb in Virginia, John Tester in Montana, Bob Casey in Pennsylvania. There's one more that is slipping my mind at the moment, but there were four of them, four senators that ran on, Claire McCaskill, who arguably was not quite as pro-gun rights as the other three, but still talked a decent game.
Back then, too, is different than today.
Right. So, and a number of House Democrats also won ousted Republicans with pro-gun rhetoric. Barack Obama in 2008 follows that cue. There was the Supreme Court ruling that enshrined individual Second Amendment rights. Barack Obama does not criticize the ruling, says it tracks his views. You know, I believe that what works in Chicago doesn't work in Cheyenne. I've always respected Second Amendment rights, blah, blah, blah. And in that first term, he does not go into gun control at all, even though there's several mass shootings. So that worked. That's the hard reality, is that worked. And you had some people in the pro-gun control side saying, hey, you're over-interpreting that. It's not really about guns. It's about all these other factors. But you can keep saying that.
Yeah. But the other point, too, which I'm sure you talk about, is Planned Parenthood and the feminists and Planned Parenthood are a much more powerful coalition than the James Brady group or whatever.
Yeah.
They don't have the organization and the constituency.
Well, I mean, NARAL is immensely powerful. Planned Parenthood is immensely powerful. They have huge grassroots membership donor bases. The Democratic primary electorate is majority women, 58% women in the last primary, and of course plenty of men are pro-choice as well, but you have a lot of single issue pro-choice voters, and that's an issue that is on your mind all the time. Everybody has sex, everybody uses contraception, a huge proportion of women have gotten abortions or have children they think might need an abortion someday. So it's much more top of mind on a daily basis, unlike guns, which is only top of mind after a public mass shooting, unless you're in an area where you're directly affected by it.
Right.
So there is that structural reason why the gun control movement doesn't have the same clout as the pro-choice movement. But there's also this factor that as a political matter, downplaying gun control has been a proven electoral winner in a way that pro-choice stances. Look, Montana is a pro-choice state, is a majority pro-choice state.
That goes to the libertarian nature of the West, and it's like, leave me alone, let me do my own thing. So it's somewhat consistent with it's an individualistic, some would say selfish worldview. But that's in keeping with it. Super interesting. I would say this, though, the gun thing, the other difference is that there are these moments, right? So the next time there's a big shooting, there will be a backlash. Now, it won't sustain probably, but there could be a period of weeks or months, depending on the timing of when this horrific next event will happen. That it could be interesting to see what happens to a party or candidates who are compromising on this issue.
And if Quist wins on that message, the debate becomes even harder when that mass shooting occurs. Because the moral urge is going to be there. We have someone say, look, we just won. We just won this critical race with a guy downplaying it. How can you look away from that electoral fact?
Yeah. And the truth is, no matter how you feel about guns or the Second Amendment or like the efficacy of registration or any of that stuff, because we just had a bombing the other day in Manchester. I mean, it's not just guns. But regardless of how you feel about like the merits of that, it does seem like it is a truism that that Democrats are better off avoiding that issue electorally. And maybe it'll change in 100 years, but for the last however many years. It's been smart money electorally. Is to stay away for Dems to stay away from that issue.
Well, let's shift gears because you wrote a piece in the Daily Beast about Sean Hannity and the widely debunked Seth Rich WikiLeaks conspiracy, where you were highly critical of Sean Hannity, critical of Newt Gingrich, critical of Rush Limbaugh. The conservative media doesn't can't traffic in these widely debunked conspiracies. After you wrote that, Sean Hannity kind of, you know, he didn't retract anything, but said
FoxNews.com retracted right. their story.
Right.
And then Hannity has said, I think he finally said he won't, that he's going to not talk about it for now.
Right.
Something like that.
So do you feel, is this a victory for truth in conservative media, or is this a strategic retreat on Hannity's part that's not going to change, you know, how the info wars of the world are increasingly dominant in conservative media?
Well, I hope that it actually is policing the right. You know, one of my arguments has always been that, you know, there need to be adults who are policing the right. Now, the truth is, in today's world where anybody can have a website and whatever, you can't sort of enforce conformity or even good behavior. So we can't control what InfoWars is going to do. But that's okay. There have always been fringy elements and fringy sites, and fringe books, whatever. You can't control that. But Fox News is a mainstream conservative outlet. And I think that they were shamed into doing the right thing. And I think that's a victory for everybody. I even think it's a victory, as I write, I even think it's a victory for them, because if they're trafficking in the fever swamps, then that doesn't differentiate them from their competition on the right. That, you know, the one thing that they should be seen as the standard of conservative media. And so I just don't think it was a good business move for them to, like, replicate the worst actors on the right. But ultimately, I think this is just a good thing for the movement, never mind Fox's business, for the conservative movement and for all of us.
Well, I certainly get, you know, for the movement, you want to see the conservative movement be pristine and be seen as credible, not seen as a lunatic enterprise. As a business matter and as a political matter, you know, we selected a conspiracy theorist as president. The guy ran on birtherism, and, you know, only retracted it in the most gaslighting of ways. No one took it very seriously, and has thrown out create. You know, he ran in the primary on Ted Cruz's dad helped kill JFK. InfoWars does have a large audience. People, there are people that still believe.
In fairness, Trump also ran on Ted Cruz's wife being ugly. That was the other.
Duly noted.
Some message.
Does a Fox News need to appeal to this audience? Because obviously, the InfoWars side of things is pulling people towards them. Do you have to dive into that swamp to survive in today's conservative media, or is there enough of a market for credible conservative news?
That's a good question. I would certainly hope that there is. I mean, you know, there are great things on Fox News. There are, Brett Baer and Chris Wallace. There's a lot of really good stuff. But then you have the Hannitys and formerly the O'Reillys of the world. And, I mean, I do think that they are responding to incentives to a certain degree. And and it's not like, you know, the left doesn't also, you know, engage in these things as well sometimes. But, look, if you have to make up stuff to succeed or to compete, then I think that's a bridge too far, personally. Now, it's easy for me to say, in a sense, it's easier for me to say because I'm not running Fox News. But, I mean, I could maybe be making more money if I, like, made up stuff. I don't know. I wouldn't do it because it's not – you just don't do that, you know?
So
– that's not who we are.
How long do you think Hannity has at Fox? You know, basically the regime, the Ailes regime in the upper echelon of the operation is largely gone. He had said if they get rid of Bill Shine that the Fox News we know will be no more, and that guy got whacked, and people thought Hannity might quit that day, and he didn't. He put out a tweet before a show last night that he's going to talk about his future at Fox, and then didn't really say very much. You know, he said, I serve at the pleasure of Fox News, which seems sort of, you know, factually wrong. You can quit. You're allowed to quit. Do you think within the conservative movement that there's a faction that now sees Hannity in a discredited light?
Totally. No, it's very interesting. I mean, there was a time, you know, not that many years ago, where I think all of us were sort of on the same page, you know. But now I think that there are, you know, people like Jonah Goldberg, who is a contributor at Fox, like mocks Sean Hannity. I think, like, basically it's impossible now to be a serious conservative who defends Hannity, or Limbaugh for that matter. And it wasn't always that way. It used to be these things were not mutual. We used to all sort of peacefully coexist. And it's gotten to the point now where you cannot, like, in good conscience abide what they're saying or doing. And I just don't know how tenable that is. I mean, it's weird to have a guy who's your primetime host that other people at the network sort of mock as a hack. So it's a weird. I don't know if it's tenable or not. It's an unusual situation, and certainly hasn't always been this way.
Where could he go?
Well, I mean, he probably doesn't even need to go anywhere. I'm sure he's loaded, right?
Right.
But there's the One America News. There's the, you know, well, I guess. No, wasn't Bill O'Reilly doing something with Glenn Beck? Did I see that?
Well, I think he's being a guest on the show once a week.
Is that what it was? Okay.
Yeah, I don't think it's that robust. I don't know if it's even paid.
I mean, I guess the idea of Roger Ailes starting his own network or website's not going to happen now that he's dead. So, yeah, I mean, who knows? Like, I don't know why these people always feel like, I mean, Greta, like, was gone for 15 minutes and now she's, like, at MSNBC. I don't know why people always feel like, well, Bill, we just keep repeating ourselves. You said last week that if people feel like if they retire from the Supreme Court, they'll be dead 15 minutes later, right?
Right.
So I guess that's why people can't just go away.
Right.
At some point, you're a certain age, you've made millions and millions of dollars. I feel like I'd be more than happy to just go to the beach. Or at least take a couple years.
No, I imagine if you're Hannity, you've now... You have some loyal following. Obviously, he's discredited in some corners, but is beloved in others. You want to do something with that. You want to monetize it. So do you do a Glenn Beck and strike out on your own, or do you hook up with a One American News or Newsmax? Or
he would still have his radio show. He could have somebody write books for him, like Bill O'Reilly does.
Right.
The weird thing about Hannity is that he, if you go back and look at, like, so, like, when people like me, and I was by no means at the forefront of this, but when people like me were, like, criticizing George W. Bush, and George W. Bush is, like, the consummate establishment Republican, right? I mean, you would think. When I was criticizing Bush for being, you know, for not being conservative enough, Hannity was, like, carrying that guy's water, kissing his butt. And then... Wasn't Hannity like a big Romney guy maybe, or he might have, I don't know. But like at some point then Hannity became like, he like outflanked us and became like more conservative than we were somehow. Or,
well, I was like, Hannity is sort of this consummate party hack.
I don't know what it is.
I mean, he seemed to want to avoid intra-party squabbles. you know, after 2012, he was out there saying we gotta recalibrate on immigration if we're gonna win as a party again.
Right.
So
that's a good point.
I never looked at him as someone trying to be more ideologically pure than others. I looked at him as being more party loyal than others. I mean, and the difference is that Trump is the party now.
Yeah, but it's equally like judgmental. Mm-hmm. Instead of enforcing an ideological purity test and burning apostates, it's the party enforcement that if you're not 100% for your team, your party, then you're, so if you're putting ideas or consistency or honesty, integrity, not attacking a dead guy's family or at least making them feel like, if you're putting all those values ahead of your party, you're on the wrong side of them.
Well, I mean, I need to go in a little bit, but I do want to self-promote one more thing.
Yes.
Which is the political piece I wrote over the weekend, The Outrageously Early Field Guide to 2020, which the first line of the article is about the nascent Democratic field for president. The first line of the piece is, I can already hear your complaints. It's too early to talk about 2020. And almost every tweet in my feed is, you bastard, how dare you talk about 2020, is irresponsible, you hack. But I get that there is a special, like, there are special elections, there's 2018, there's the actual Trump presidency. I'm not saying these things aren't important to talk about. The reality is, if you are running for president, there are things you have to be doing now. And to the extent that it matters to you and me, it's not so much about the donors you have to meet or the Iowa volunteers you have to cultivate. You know, that's just sort of, that's the game. But there are these open questions about what does the party stand for? What do Democrats think is needed to combat Trump? And the emerging field are testing those messages and those issue positions, and they're doing it in a way that they're going to naturally bump up against one another. So the way I structured it in the piece was, they're all looking to win badges, like when you play Candy Crush, you're trying to win badges. And there's a populist badge, there's a Heartlander badge, and there's a reproductive freedom fighter badge, there's a commander-in-chief badge. So, you know, obviously everyone thinks right now that to be the uber populist is the way to go. Well, who is the uber populist? Is it Warren? Is it Sanders? Is it Biden? Is it Sherrod Brown? You know, they're not going to be kumbaya about it. They're trying to outdo one another, and you have to look at what they say publicly in that light, because it's just a plain fact. So I don't think it is journalistic hackery to talk about it. It's what is happening in the political realm, and if you care about what the Democratic Party stands for, you want to shape that debate, you have to understand that's what's going on right now.
Oh, yeah, far be it from me to criticize. I encourage the horse race stuff as much as I can, frankly. Nothing else it could take our mind off of the more scary things that are happening. And if you're a Democrat, it's in a way, it's therapeutic to dream, to talk about, think about what could be. So I encourage
this. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it. I know you're a busy man.
I did take a look.
Do you have a sense of who you think is, you know, creme de la creme of, I mean, I need about 20 people, and I got people on my feed saying, you forgot Deval Patrick, you forgot Adam Schiff. You know, actually, I wasn't trying to be comprehensive. I was trying to illustrate how the possible candidates are positioning themselves. But having said that, are there people that you think are people to keep an eye on?
Well, I think you hit you did a great job of assembling the politicians who I think are in play, who are jockeying for position. To me, there's two paths here. The first path is, what we've learned is that most of the time people go for the exact opposite of the other guy. So Obama's the opposite of Bush. Trump's the opposite of Obama. So that means maybe now we come back to the opposite of Trump, which is why we would need someone who is serious, thoughtful, all those things, statesmanlike, right? Except that assumes like this oscillation would continue rather than the fact that this is a linear progression, which is a race to the bottom, which is to say that we have now entered into a time when you have to be a celebrity to get to be the president. So for that reason, I believe that the Democrats will nominate somebody like a Mark Cuban or an Oprah Winfrey. And I'm not joking. maybe Michelle Obama, I don't think she'll run, but she would be great if she did. But I think that it will be somebody who has some sort of a George Clooney. I guess your boy isn't going to run now out in Minnesota, Al Franken.
Well, so he says. He
says he's not running.
Everyone says that. Yet he's on a book tour. So I would say what anybody says in 2017 as determinative what they might do in, or maybe really be next year. I mean, people are going to announce after the midterms.
So the Dems have the superdelegates.
Well, that's being debated right now whether we'll still have them, but. As of today, they have
keep them, Bill. Keep them.
But but your point about celebrities is potentially in conflict with what you said about doing the opposite of Trump.
I know. Those are two competing theories.
The full opposite of Trump is an experienced legislature or governor, someone who's boring. Someone who says you've tried
Paul Simon, the politician, right. Not the singer.
Right, right. So I had in my badges, because the going theory is we need a super populist. Well, what if you need someone who's very experienced? You have Governor Andrew Cuomo, who can point to his minimum wage and his fracking ban. You have John Hickenlooper, who has the best state economies in Colorado. You have Jerry Brown, who I got a lot of mockery in my feed, like how crazy that you put Jerry Brown on this list. I mean, the guy would be 82, but Sanders and Warren and Biden are all up there also, and Trump is not young either. If you got the energy, you got the energy. I mean, Jerry Brown is arguably the most accomplished governor, not just by longevity's sake. I mean, he took a state that was in fiscal disrepair. Turned it around.
Thanks to a celebrity.
Right, thanks to a celebrity. He wins voter approval for tax increases to build up a surplus, and wins re-election. I didn't even emphasize this in the piece. I'm just fascinated. He won re-election without spending any money. He spent nothing on his own campaign, and he won re-election. I mean, that's astonishing. So he's run three times before. These guys, they get the itch, and it never really goes away. So, these are people that could go into camp against Trump and say, look, I know how to actually do things. I've governed a big state, in the case of New York and California. I know how to make economies work. You've tried it that way. Now, Terry McAuliffe, someone else who's not really a populist type, I had him in my list as a potential brawler badge winner. But he also has voter rights cred, remember, Democratic electorate, heavily non-white. Last two nominees, one in the Black Belt going through the southern states. You cannot ignore that constituency. And McAuliffe, not many people know this, has individually restored 150,000 people to the voter rolls who were ex-felons. And he tried to do it in one fell swoop, and he got smacked down by the courts about that. And so they said, you got to do it case by case. So he individually restored the rights of 100,000 people. I mean, that's just tangible restoration of people's constitutional rights. So he can bring that into a campaign and say, look, I'm the real deal. I've actually done this. I know how much it matters, and I have the record to prove it. So there's a lot of ways that this race can be shaped. I mean, all depends on who actually decides to run, but I think there are a lot of ways this could go that would not be hospitable to a Mark Cuban or an Oprah Winfrey or Sheryl Sandberg or somebody like that. Did I lose you?
Well, we are having website issues. Okay.
Can you hear me?
So I guess maybe we should. I can hear you now. Maybe we should call it a day.
We can call it a day.
And maybe it's the internet. It might be the internet where I am.
Okay. But I think we're fine otherwise.
Why don't you wrap it up and
Okay.
Okay, why don't you wrap it up and plug our stuff?
All right, so this is the DMZ on bloggingheads.tv. Check us out on iTunes or wherever fine podcasts are sold. Check out Matt Lewis at the Daily Beast and on CNN, where he's on Anderson Cooper, he's on Don Lemon, he's on New Day. And check out my upcoming political article on Democrats and guns. And we'll talk next week, I bet, about what happened in Montana.
Yeah, Bill. All right. Good show. Thanks, man. See you guys.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.